Welcome to DC Specialcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstar, Super DC Giant, Four-Star, Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know that they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. Today, I am joined in person right here in the DC Specialcast studio with my brother-in-law, Todd Sarenbetz. Hey, Todd, welcome to DC Specialcast.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me.
We do need to take a minute before we get started to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Specialcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping of $50 or more. Todd, did you bring a pick for us?
I sure did, Paul. I picked the Superman Brainiac Reborn Omnibus. This was a collection of stories that I read live when they came out. Mm-hmm. They were right around the Triangle era. I think they happened right before the Triangle era. And I happen to be really enjoying those Triangle era omnibuses. I also had the Superman in Exile omnibus, which was excellent. So I'm really excited to get this. Written by Roger Stern, Jerry Ordway, Dan Jurgens, and others, with art by Cary Gamble, Jerry Ordway, Dan Jurgens, and others, and it's set immediately before Superman the Triangle Era Omnibus Volume 1. These are the stories that would define the Man of Steel for a new era. It collects Action Comics number 647 to 658, Superman number 38 to 48, Adventures of Superman number 461 to 471, Superman Under a Yellow Sun, Lex Luthor, The Unauthorized Biography, Superman Special No. 1, Legion 90, Annual No. 1, and Adventures of Superman Annual No. 2, with a foreword by Roger Stern, never-before-seen behind-the-scene extras and more. The total page count for this is 1,256 pages. It's a whopper. Price is $150, but on in-stock trades, it's $90, a 40% discount.
Oh, that's an excellent one. My pick is Wonder Woman, the Golden Age Omnibus Hardcover Volume 1 by William Moulton Marston and Harry G. Peter. It includes the story from this very episode. In these stories, Wonder Woman travels from Paradise Island to Man's World, where she serves as an emissary of peace, using her bracelets and lassos of truth to stop injustice. Collects All-Star Comics number 8, Sensation Comics 1 to 24, Wonder Woman 1 to 7, and stories from Comics Cavalcade 1 to 4. 776 pages, $100. In stock price saves you 40% for $60. Very exciting. All right, now we're going to get to what we're talking about today. Today is our first chance to talk about Four Star Spectacular. This is Four Star Spectacular number 4. The cover date is September-October 1976 and was on sale, according to Mike's Amazing World, June 10th, 1976. It costs a whopping 50 cents for 48 pages and edited by the legendary E. Nelson Bridwell. So Todd, when I first talked to you about DC Specialcast, you said, oh, I want to do this issue, number 4. Tell everybody why.
The original book that I would have loved to have done too was the Sports Spectacular that had the villains and the heroes playing baseball. But that was picked by somebody else, which was totally fine. But I chose this one because it was really the only other book that I actually purchased as a kid. At the time, I was living in South America in Colombia. Comics were the only reading material that was in English that anybody could get a hold of. And I was going to my local Sears every week with my family and we'd pick up a bunch of comics. And this is one of the ones that I picked up and I have kept. It managed several moves across the continents and I still have it right now. I'm looking at it. It's got a nice little mark on the middle of the cover. I think the first number is like 6 and then the next two numbers are 30. So I think this book cost 630 pesos back in, at the Sears in Cali, Colombia.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Mine as well is the copy that I got when I was just a little bit older, 11 years old, 1976, and I've still got it today. You might be asking, what is Four Star Spectacular? We have not had one of these. So I'm going to give a very brief history of what this was. It was an anthology series that DC published from 1976 to 77, edited by E. Nelson Bridwell, and it ran for only 6 issues. They were all giant size format and consisted of reprints of different superheroes. A total of 4 characters appeared in each issue, hence the title. But 3 out of the 6 issues only featured 3 stories, which did cause some consternation in the letter column, which we will see. Each issue featured a Superboy story, and a Wonder Woman story, and at least one other story, usually a team-up story. All issues featured new cover art by Ernie Chan, who, of course, as we've discussed before, was DC's primary cover artist at the time. And finally, before Chris Franklin points it out in the comments, Four Star Spectacular was the title of an episode of Batman the Brave and the Bold, which was an anthology starring Adam Strange, The Flash, Amazing Man, and the Creature Commandos, with Batman as only a minor character. All right, moving on to Wayne's Special Investments. It looks to me, you can get a copy of this book pretty cheap online, $3 tops plus shipping. You can probably get it a little cheaper at a show if you can find it. But more interesting are some of the original issues that the stories came from. So the Wonder Woman story comes from Sensation Comics number 19 from 1943. I only saw one on eBay, which was coverless for $695.
Yikes.
So I went and looked at the history on Heritage Auction. In September of 2025, a CGC 9.4 copy of Sensation Comics number 19 sold for $24,000. But if you want it, the buyer is taking offers for a mere $36,000 or more.
And I think that might actually be pesos.
Oh, is that pesos? Okay, I don't know. A more reasonable 5.5 sold at Heritage for $900 in early 2025. But Heritage only showed 10 copies sold in the last 10 years in any condition. So it goes to show you the rarity of it. Superboy story came from Superboy number 62, 1958. It runs $30 to maybe $50 to $70 based on the listings I see. And then Hawkman number 7, sellers are asking $20 to $50. And some are trying to get more for high grades. But this is the kind of thing dealers at shows love to accept offers on, since it's not a high volume for Hawkman books. So like I say, dropping $3 or $4 for this four-star spectacular is a pretty spectacular deal.
Yeah.
So the issue itself is not on DC Universe Infinite, but I will mention how else you might be able to read each story when we get there. There were some terrific books published by DC in June 1976. A special place in my heart must go to Detective 463, where Batman battles the Black Spider. But more importantly, the Atom deals with the first appearance of the Calculator. Of course, Sean and I covered this on Catch You Later Calculator segment back in January, but we also saw the final issue of The Joker, number 9, where he takes on Catwoman, and JLA 134, which guest stars Supergirl. For Marvel, we got Nova number 1, Avengers 151 with a new lineup, and the Treasury Edition, Captain America's Bicentennial Battles. Todd, any favorites from this month?
Well, definitely Batman Family number 7, was one of my favorites from that series, and Joker number 9. Both those books I bought at the time, and I still have them. I'm also a big Legion fan, so Superboy 219, which featured a battle between the Legion and the Fatal Five, is definitely high on my list. And then, of course, the Bicentennial Captain America Treasury Edition by Kirby and other Marvel Legends stands out.
All right. Thanks again to my favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Now let's get into our comic for real. Todd, would you like to describe the cover by Ernie Chan?
Sure. This is a cover that has obviously the four-star spectacular banner, which takes up about a third of the top of the comic and includes the heads of the four featured heroes, Superboy, Wonder Woman, and Hawkman and Hawkgirl. There are three panels representing the stories inside the book. Going left to right, you have Superboy flying toward and absorbing a bolt of lightning while Smallville residents watch from below. Hawkman and Hawkgirl and the villain IQ are floating in their panel. Their bodies are separated in pieces. And then the bottom panel shows Wonder Woman swinging a large log at several men with a caption indicating that she is on a rampage. The three panels are definitely attention grabbers and convey what the stories are about. The Wonder Woman panel is mysterious. She's on a rampage, according to the caption, but we don't know if she's attacking villains or innocent bystanders. The people she's attacking don't have weapons, so it's unclear what is happening and makes the image intriguing. The only complaints that I have about the cover are that the Smallville residents in the Superboy panel are rendered simply, with little detail making them look a little out of focus. The intent, I'm sure, is to draw the eye to Superboy, but given his size on the panel, I can't imagine that a more detailed background would detract from the main subject. My other issue is with the Hawkman and Hawkgirl panel in that it lacks action. Hawkman is just taking a swing at IQ, but it's not exaggerated, so it's kind of barely perceptible. I also think it would be more effective if IQ's disembodied arms were attacking each of the Hawks. As it stands, they're just kind of like floating out towards the reader in space, and his legs are kind of floating out, which kind of makes you not really sure what pose he's in.
I don't quite get the legs. I mean, got the bottom and top of Hawkman and Hawkgirl, and they're just split into two pieces, but he's missing his whole body, which I think is pretty funny.
But otherwise, you know, typical Ernie Chan cover, very well rendered. Heroes look exactly like they should look according to the style guides. You know, overall, a great cover.
Yeah. Can't say anything else. I love the the heads. I always like the heads at the top when they tell you who's in it. You got the four heads inside stars because it's the four star spectacular. I don't think Chan drew these heads, though, because the Wonder Woman definitely looks like a Dick Giordano. The Hawkman and Hawkgirl look like a Murphy Anderson or maybe even Kubert. I don't know about Superboy. Maybe that's a Kurt Swan. I don't know. We do not, unfortunately, get a table of contents for the issue. We have to jump right in. But, of course, I will post the cover and several other pages on the gallery page for DC Special Cast at fireandwaterpodcast.com. All right, our first story, starting the Golden Age Wonder Woman, is entitled The Unbound Amazon. It's a 13-pager written by Wonder Woman's creator, William Moulton Marston. And the artist is Frank Godwin, not H.G. Peter. So hang on to that thought. As I mentioned before, it's reprinted from Sensation Comics number 19, 1943, and has been reprinted several times in Wonder Woman Archives, Volume 3, and the Wonder Woman Golden Age Omnibus Volume 1, which I mentioned before, and in a trade paperback, the Golden Age Volume 2. You can read Sensation Comics number 19, at least the Wonder Woman story, on DC Universe Infinite. Todd, would you like to read the synopsis, please?
Sure. Steve Trevor receives a letter from a young boy in Skowhegan, Maine, named Bobby Lee, asking him to contact Wonder Woman. The letter says that his teacher, Miss Ann Pinkey, is in trouble, and that it involves a woman named Mavis, and even an enemy plot. Steve dismisses the letter as childish worries, but Diana is not so sure. That night, Diana receives a mental radio call from Mala on Paradise Island. Mala tells Diana that her prisoner, the evil Mavis, has escaped, and she may be in America. Diana figures she had better head up to Maine to see if these Mavises are one and the same. Meanwhile, at Bobby's school, Miss Pinkey is paid a visit by her boyfriend, Leon Dexter, but she doesn't want anything to do with him. She believes he has taken up with Mavis and is planning some sort of sabotage. Bobby comforts Miss Pinkey after Leon has left and then goes to the train station to wait for Wonder Woman. When Diana arrives, they head to Anne's house that she shares with her mother, but they find her mother unconscious. Anne Pinkey has been kidnapped. Diana pursues them, but the kidnappers throw Anne into a quagmire. Wonder Woman ties her magic lasso to a tree and the other end around her waist and jumps in to save her. But the tricky Mavis grabs the other end of the lasso, and now Wonder Woman is under her control. The gang takes them both back to the hideout where Mavis embraces Leon, much to Anne's dismay. She is now sure that he is a traitor. But then Leon grabs Anne and runs away. By this time, Steve and Edda have arrived with the Amazon scientist Paula to help. They stop the bad guys from shooting Leon and Anne while Leon runs away down the river on the logs. Meanwhile, Mavis taunts Wonder Woman and thinks that by removing her bracelets, it will weaken her. But with the bracelets removed, Wonder Woman's Amazon strength lacks control and she goes crazy, breaking free, knocking over the hideout cabin, and clobbering all the Germans and Mavis. She then chases down Leon and is throttling him when Paula arrives just in time to help Diana regain her bracelets and control. Leon is revealed not to be a traitor, but rather an intelligence agent working to capture Mavis and her followers. Now he and Anne can get married and live happily ever after. The end.
All right. I'll just mention this. In Mike's Amazing World, it says that this is the first time that we see Wonder Woman lose her bracelets and thus lose control. So, Todd, what did you think of this story overall?
Well, I remember as a kid being surprised at Wonder Woman being on a rampage. That's usually Hulk's job description, not hers. So I didn't know much about the Golden Age Wonder Woman lore. All I knew about her really was from her appearances in the Justice League and her live-action TV show and the Super Friends. Mm-hmm. What stands out for me now after I reread the story is the details about her bracelets. Binding them, which villainous Mavis did in a previous issue, eliminates her power, but removing them takes away her feminine characteristics and she becomes destructive like a man. Mm-hmm. This story has appearances from many of Wonder Woman's supporting characters, as well as recurring villain Mavis and her Nazi henchmen. Even Bobby, the boy who gets Wonder Woman to investigate the strange goings-on in the town, is a character from a previous story.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I looked that up, too. He had previously appeared one other time, two issues earlier, in Sensation Comics number 17. Synopsis of that story is wild. Kids are at the zoo, and they hear a talking lion, and none of the adults believe them. But it turns out the lion had swallowed a radio, and Nazis were somehow using them to communicate.
What an insidious plot.
And that one, and I'm like, as I'm reading that summary, that sounds vaguely familiar. And then I realized that was reprinted in Four Star Spectacular number 1.
Jeez.
Which I haven't read for 30 years.
Yeah, I think I just like the one of the things that I love. It's a golden age story, so it's pretty dense. You know, there's a lot of words. There's a lot of story compacted in a very short number of pages, smaller panels. But again, it was, you know, especially as a kid, you're just like, I'm just absorbing all that stuff. So learning all about this Wonder Woman and all her side characters, you know, just absorbing all that stuff. So I really enjoyed that part. And then obviously being on this like logger town and having her like run across like all these logs, and she in her rampage, she takes there's a log jam. She takes out the center log that's causing the jam, and it releases all logs. It just seemed really like kind of cool that, you know, obviously we don't see the Hulk for, you know, 20 more years in the 60s, but it's kind of the vibe that you get just going on a rampage. And I even liked when she's, you know, enraged and out of control, and she's like, destroy, destroy, kill, kill. So no Wonder Woman smash, but, you know, not too bad dialogue otherwise.
Yeah, no, it was great. I thought the art was pretty good by this fellow Frank Godwin. I really like the splash page here. You've got Wonder Woman picking up a big log. We don't know quite what she's doing with it, but you can tell there's no bracelet here. You don't notice that unless you know what's going on in the story. Bobby has written Wonder Woman a letter, care of Steve Trevor. You know, then we get a lot of scenes of Miss Pinky in the school with the kids. And the kids look like kids. And, you know, that's hard to do sometimes. But she doesn't want to have anything to do with her fiancé. But what I really like is we see Wonder Woman do a lot of things. She's racing the train for fun.
Yeah.
Right? The train comes in, Bobby's waiting for her, and she's just racing the train for fun. And, you know, this is 1943. Wonder Woman's been around 2 years now, right? And it's like still an exciting thing for kids to be reading about. You know, not everybody's going to be familiar with her. But it is interesting that a lot of the characters are introduced that have been recurring. And they don't make a big deal of it, you know? There's no three-page summary of the last time she met Bobby. It's just she mentions he met him before.
Right.
That's it. So I kind of like that.
Yeah, it doesn't require... They don't presume that you have to know everything about Wonder Woman and all the side characters, and they just keep the story moving along.
Yeah, but if you do, it's great, because, you know, Mavis is in other stories, and Paula, of course, we've talked about Paula on the podcast before. She was a Nazi, got reformed, and then she's, you know, the chief scientist of the Amazons now, so all kinds of cool stuff. I thought the way she saved the girl from the quicksand was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So Wonder Woman ties her lasso around a tree. She grabs a piece of a log to float, and then she grabs Miss Pinky using her legs, and then she's going to pull her up. But the thing she doesn't take count of is she had tied her lasso to the tree, and Mavis just holds the lasso and says, now you're under my control. So that I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, the thing I love about quicksand, too, I think I've learned how to deal with quicksand either from this Wonder Woman story and also the Batman story, I think, with Blockbuster. So I've learned, you know, how if I ever encounter quicksand, I know what to do. So I'm still looking for it. I haven't found it anywhere, but one of these days I'm sure I will find it, and we'll know what to do.
Gilligan's Island.
I was going to say Gilligan's Island is the same thing. I just thought of Gilligan's Island too.
And so then we see, you know, Mavis takes Wonder Woman and the girl to their camp. They're Heil Hitlering, and she ties her up. And Miss Pinky is very sad because she sees Leon embrace Mavis. But Leon does a weird thing. He then grabs Miss Pinky and runs away with her, shooting at her. Steve has arrived there in the invisible jet with Paula and Etta. They see him run by, and Steve takes care of the Nazis. And then I love this move here where Wonder Woman is hanging from her lasso, but she grabs Mavis by the ankles and whams her down onto the ground, which is great. Now she's enraged because Mavis has removed her bracelet with a dagger that contains acid, which flows out of the tip and dissolves the hardest metal.
Can't argue with that.
They haven't invented femizonium at that point. And then it's just cool that we get a lot of Wonder Woman rampaging. She's running along the logs. I love this scene of all the logs in the river. There's a big backlog, I guess you call that, right? A big
log jam.
Log jam. I guess that's where we get our words from. And Wonder Woman's so enraged, she crash, and clears it out. And then she goes to throttle Leon. But of course, Paula gets there in time and with a lasso and calms her down. And then she's going to make new bracelets for her. And we get a nice ending with
Miss Pinky.
Miss Pinky and Leon, you know, getting married, because turns out he's a double agent. He's a spy for the U.S. I like that.
The other thing I too that I like in the little classroom scene at the very beginning, Bobby knows something's going on with Miss Pinky. And then when he comes in to see her, he notices that she's got a dress on that he calls her mad dress.
Oh, yeah.
and he warns all the students, like, don't take her off. She's in her mad dress today.
That was funny.
And it really, like, you know, I don't know if any of my teachers ever had mad dresses, but I can totally see that's something that you would do as young. So whoever wrote this was definitely channeling their inner school child, because that's awesome. I think they nailed that one.
Yeah, that's good. And just, you know, nice details in here with the art. You've got a blackboard. And it's got arithmetic on the blackboard and spelling words like cat and dog. These must be little kids. And then there's a picture of Abraham Lincoln and a globe of the world. So it's just nice. Nice little thing. So good story overall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we go on to the next ones, I'd say the name of Frank Goodwin did surprise me, since I expected H.G. Peter on the art. Godwin was much better known as a comic strip artist. His best-known strips were Connie, that ran from 1927 to 1944, and Rusty Riley, that ran from 1948 to 1959. So he was born in 1889 in Washington, D.C. He's the oldest creator I've done a segment on, I think. He was the son of the Washington Star's city editor, and at age 16 in 1905, he began as an apprentice on the paper. He then went to New York to study at the Art Students League, and eventually opened a studio with another artist named James Montgomery Flagg. Flagg is known for his political art, but most of all, he created the iconic Uncle Sam, I Want You, for the Army in 1917. So this guy's studio mate. Back to Godwin. Mike's Amazing World lists 132 comic book story credits for him, but that's really misleading. Godwin's long-running strip, Connie, was actually reprinted every month in Famous Funnies. In fact, Connie appeared in what is generally acknowledged as the first ever comic book, Famous Funnies number one. Hmm. Godwin only did 4 Wonder Woman stories for DC, including this one. I'm sure that William Moulton Marston couldn't pay him what he was making from his comic strip, which was much more lucrative at that time. Wikipedia says he did some other comic book for Lev Gleason in the 1940s, but I could not figure out which ones. But he did do some book illustrations for novels such as Treasure Island and Kidnapped and Robinson Crusoe, and others that people of our age probably read in grade school. I'm not sure if any of you guys has ever read Tom Brevoort's blog online, but he writes about comics that he had when he was a kid. He wrote this about Godwin in his review for this issue of 4-Star.
The issue opens with a classic early Wonder Woman story by creator William Marston, but illustrated not by the series' visual originator, H.G. Peter, but rather the more polished Frank Godwin. Godwin did a string of Wonder Woman stories for a short period of time, but failed to become a fixture on the series. His style was more contemporary than Peter's, and you can almost see somebody up at the All-American offices trying to make Wonder Woman more visually appealing to a then-modern audience.
Ouch. I mean, I always have liked H.G. Peter's art. I think it's very weird. But cool, you know, I like it. But anyway, Godwin said of himself that he was a, quote, frustrated engineer. Apparently, he had a wood and metal shop in his home in Bucks County, PA, which is north of Philadelphia and not far from we are and where Todd's parents live.
Yeah.
And he built a real working model steam engine that measured 4 feet long. I thought that was interesting. So Godwin passed away in 1959 at the age of 70. Believe it or not, he still has fans today. There is a Facebook fan group for his art that has over 2,000 members.
Wow.
I thought that was amazing. Anyway, I enjoyed learning about him, somebody I just never heard of before.
All right.
All right, let's move on to our second story. This one stars Superboy. It's called The Wildest Weather in the World, and the writer is Otto Binder with art by John Sekela, and it was reprinted from Superboy number 62, 1958. Unfortunately, as far as I can tell, this has never been reprinted elsewhere. It's not on DC Universe Infinite, nor is it in the Superboy DC Finest that came out last year. Maybe if there's another volume of that, we'll be able to find it there. So Todd, you want to do the honors again?
Sure. Professor Lang has discovered an idol with a strange curse attached. He tells Clark that the curse says that exposing the idol to the color green causes it to alter the weather. Of course, Clark is wearing a green tie, and a heat wave ensues. Superboy creates a giant umbrella to shade Smallville until the heat dies down. The next day, Professor Lang inadvertently wears a green hat, causing the idol to start an extreme cold snap. Superboy flies into the sun, superheating himself, and flies around the Smallville, warming things up. Now curious, Clark investigates the idol with his X-ray vision. He sees flecks of radium in its eyes, and of course that radiation causes the extreme weather. Comic book science. The next day, despite the avoidance of green, the idol is set off once again when Professor Lang unpacks an ancient tribal jack-in-the-box that is green when it pops out. I wonder what tribe that was. This time, the green exposure causes severe lightning storms, and Superboy constructs a giant lightning rod to protect Smallville. Superboy tries to neutralize his idol's influence by following the words of the curse, which claims the only thing that can appease the wrathful spirit is a living rainbow. He tries a few solutions, like somehow painting a cloud, but nothing works. He eventually flies by the idol in the primary colors of his own costume, and that neutralizes the idol's power. Again, comic book science. The end.
What do you think of this little story, Todd?
Well, Superboy comics, I'm going to be honest, were never my favorite as a kid, unless he was a little older and teaming up with a legion of superheroes. Yeah. And this story is just kind of so-so. It has a fantastical premise that gets wrapped up in six pages with a fantastical solution that Superboy discovers. He has to deal with various weather events, also coming up with a fantastic way to solve the problem. You know, it's not something that we, the readers, are really going to be, you know, he's going to go fly into the sun and absorb the sun's powers, then fly over Smallville. I mean, that's kind of the fun of comics, is that they come up with these fantastic ideas and you've got to come up with solutions to those ideas. The Superboy series at the time were made up of three stories, usually eight pages each. And this story is six pages. So given that the Hawkman story was longer, about 15 pages in this issue of Four Star Spectacular, I imagine that Superboy's story was chosen because of its length, not because it was one of the best of his adventures.
Yeah, no, that's a fair comment. You know, it's interesting. Nelson Bridwell was the king of picking reprints, right? He edited all the reprint line. You know, maybe they cut some out of the story. You know?
Well, actually, I did look, and in the original Superboy, it says it was six pages, yeah.
All right, fair enough. Not a lot to say about this. I think it's pretty funny with all this crazy weather happening. There's apparently a giant river that runs right by Smallville.
I had no idea.
As it is in Kansas. I don't know. Superboy makes a giant parasol, which I think is pretty funny. I do like how Superboy at least is trying to figure it out. He goes back and he's looking at the idol and he says, I can't smash it, and so I'll just have to wait till tomorrow morning. Well, why couldn't they have gone back that night and just gotten rid of the idol and
buried it?
Yeah, and just buried it somewhere, but no. And then this Jack in the Box, that was totally random. That was probably my favorite part of the story, is a Jack in the Box pops out.
Yeah. And the only thing the story is missing is giant gorilla who, you know, pops out of nowhere. And
yeah. And then he tries a prism and he tries somehow painting. He says, I whipped up a special foamy paint in order to smear this cloud's face with rainbow hues. It can be seen from the museum window. Will this work? That's kind of a stretch, Superboy. I didn't think much of that one.
And the thing is, if they really wanted to solve that problem, you know, they don't have to worry, like, well, we got to make sure it's seen through the window. Could you just take the idol outside and point it towards the cloud?
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I mean, I don't have a whole lot to say more about this story, but it was fun. It's cute, but I don't think it'll highlight of the issue. We now have reached the middle of the centerfold, and we do get a full-page ad for 204 Revolutionary War Soldiers, $2.25. So stay tuned next month to find out more about this ad. That's all I'm going to have to say. But I really like the next page, which is Superboy's Workshop. It's pretty cool. You know, in that Superboy DC Finest, they had a bunch of these, because apparently this was a running feature. This one's from Superboy number 6 from 1950. It's hysterical because hello, fellers and girls.
Fellers.
Superboy says, here's something you can make, and you can make a razor blade radio. I'm sure all the parents were rushing out to give their little boys razor blades. But there's a diagram, there's instructions to how to make a radio. Just terrific. I don't know what you think of this.
This is the stuff that I think most kids these days would love to do. I think the trick is to find another piece of metal other than a razor blade, probably, to try to accomplish it.
Modern razor blades aren't even made out of the same stuff.
Yeah.
Probably even more. Who knows?
Maybe like a soda, you know, tab or something like that. But yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty cool. I do like it. And then we do get the letters page, which is called Forethought. I'm just going to say it's funny because the first letter complains about the drop in page count from 52 to 36 pages for the same 50 cents. Number one is complaining about that, which we know that the rapid inflation in the 70s and all the paper costs going up and all the price increases, which is pretty funny. But then he was complaining that there's a story short. You cheated us out of a story, Nelson. Because before they had 4 stories, and with a drop in page count, they could only do 3 stories. And so they investigated a team up. And every one of the letters mentions this, because they're like, there's a super team family. You should put the team ups there, not in this one. So there are also suggestions from another letter writer, which is fun, about who else to include. Our Man, Robot Man, Star Spangled Kid, all kinds of. Little Boy Blue. And this guy, Scott Gibson, he's been around for a while. So, you know, I think the premise of Four Star Spectacular was totally sabotaged. advertised after the first issue when the page count went down. Yeah. Because, you know, I think the original idea was they were going to have four different stories, and now they were scrambling.
Yeah, I mean, I
tough sell.
It is.
Four stars, three stories. Yeah, it doesn't really
make sense. It worked on me as a kid. Oh, obviously, yeah. I bought the issue.
Yeah.
As long as it has four different heroes, whether it's three stories or four stories, I don't think I would have cared.
Yeah, I agree. So then we go to our next feature and our final story. It is story number three, featuring Hawkman and Hawkgirl, entitled The Amazing Return of the IQ Gang. It's a 15-pager written by Gardner Fox with art by Murphy Anderson. As I mentioned earlier, reprinted from Hawkman number 7, 1965. Also has been reprinted in the Hawkman Archives Volume 2, in the Showcase Presents Hawkman Volume 1, and the DC Finest Hawkman Wings Across Time from last year. This story, Hawkman number 7, is on DC Universe Infinite, so you can read it there. And this is a good one. This one's my favorite of the issue.
Yeah, so. Mine as well.
So Todd, would you like to read the synopsis?
Sure. In his first appearance, Ira Quimby has been exposed to an alien rock from the planet Ron. That rock gave him super mental powers and IQ was born. But of course, he was defeated by Hawkman, Hawkgirl, and Adam Strange. As the story begins, we find Quimby in prison where he realizes that direct sunlight reactivates his genius. So, after getting as much sunshine as he can, he invents an invisibility-creating pinwheel, of course, that reflects light around him and thus allows him to escape. Notably, when the pinwheel makes you invisible, you can't see anything either, so IQ must memorize his way out of the prison. When alerted to the escape, Hawkman invents a device to track IQ when he uses his super brain power, but IQ creates a distorter that cancels out Katara's machine and thus is able to stay hidden and plot his evil schemes. IQ's next plot must be seen to be believed. Golden art objects from the National Gold Mining Corporation exhibit are being carried into a museum when suddenly they start flying straight up into the air. Even better, IQ and his gang are hovering above on two-wheeled air cycles that have steamship-like fans in place of wheels. They have butterfly nets that they use to capture the gold statues. Pretty clever, but Hawkman and Hawkgirl are able to stop the heist and capture most of the gang. But IQ escapes and lures the Hawks into a death trap net. Although they extricate themselves, the Winged Wonders find that he had doubled back and freed his gang. Hawkman can't trail IQ since Quimby now sabotages his power to communicate with birds. But never fear, Hawkman has left radiation on one of the gang members. Sounds healthy. And thus he and Hawkgirl track them and find their hideout. When they get there, the wildest part of the story occurs. IQ had prepared a room full of invisibility pinwheels, and everybody, including the Hawks, are invisible and blind. But Hawkman beats his wings to cancel out the pinwheels. Not to be outdone, IQ fires another device, which, working with the pinwheels, causes incredible visual distortions, almost like Murphy Anderson cut out body parts and rearranged them randomly on the page. But Katara and Shiera figure out a way to smash the pinwheels by somehow navigating their wings to the sides of the room. They recapture the IQ gang, and it's back to prison for them. The end.
All right. I love this one. I thought this was absolute riot. I'm just going to say something about the art. We got a lot of Joe Kubert fans on the network, and I have read all these Hawkman stories before from the Silver Age, and I like them all. They're pure, classic, sort of Julie Schwartz, sci-fi, Silver Age stuff. But I like Murphy Anderson as much, if not more, than Joe Kubert on Hawkman. I think his mask looks great. His facial expressions are terrific. I don't know. I really like it a lot. And we'll point out some other art pages as we go through the story, but I do like it.
I agree. I am a fan of Joe Kubert, and I love his Hawkman, but this story was really excellent. Like, the art was just terrific, and he gets all the scientific gadgets and whimsy, and I think all that stuff is just really well rendered throughout the story. So, terrific.
So, I love the splash page. This is what Ernie Chan was trying to recreate. Ernie Chan only had a tiny box to do it in, and he's got a whole page here and two or three other pages, so can't really. It's just funny. We start off, IQ is in prison, and it's raining outside, and the other inmates are making fun of him because he's standing at the window waiting for it to get sunny so that he can absorb sunlight. I just love that. A solar-powered villain. Here's a fun thing. In the footnote where we get a little backstory on IQ, it says, editor's note, see Action Comics number 443, The Amazing Thefts of the IQ Gang. Well, that Action 443 was one of those giant-sized reprints from 2 years earlier that reprinted Mystery in Space number 87. So I thought that was kind of neat. And of course, that story was Hawkman and Adam Strange. So he escapes from jail, and Hawkman's like, I got this thing, I can track him. And he's like, I think Hawkman's going to track me, so I'll make this blocker. I think that's a riot.
They're just one-upping each other throughout the episode. Whatever new invention IQ comes with, Hawkman comes up with another one, and then IQ figures out another one. I mean, it really is, like, in terms of, you know, scientific concepts, like, this issue's got like four or five of them, where normally you get like maybe one or two, and it just keep like one-upping each other. It's amazing.
I love that when they're invisible, they can't see themselves, because if you think about the Invisible Girl, other invisible characters, right? They're always able to just interact normally with the world.
Right.
But if you're truly invisible and your eyes or your bones
are,
or whatever,
how are your eyes receiving light?
Exactly. So that's,
if it's going right through you.
Exactly. So, I mean, it doesn't make a very good story unless you've memorized your way out of the prison.
Right, yeah.
But it's pretty cool.
Well, maybe the Invisible Girl has just like memorized everything on the planet, so she can get around no problem.
So the aerial action, when they have pulled their first, the things they come up with, they're riding on like unicycles with fans on the sides. It's just a riot. But the aerial action is great. Hawkgirl looks great. They're flying up there. They use their wings. You could tell Gardner Fox understands the mechanics of how Hawkman works. He talks about using their wings in different ways. And then later on, when they're trapped in the net, they talk about using the gravity. Like, the belt controls the gravity, right. The end of metal. And the wings help them steer and navigate. They do reversal on the gravity, which helps them get out of the net, which I think is just terrific.
Well, that's that classic Silver Age, you know, scientific explanation of things, where we've kind of gotten away from that. Everything's a mutant, or this is just their natural power. Like, why even talk about it? But just to at least introduce that there could be some scientific or physics-related reason why something is happening, I think that sparks imagination.
Yeah, comic book science is great. I love how Hawkman puts radiation on the bad guy, which is terrific.
Well, it's probably some Thanagarian radiation that's totally harmless, you know.
Then they get to the best scene, where Hawkman and Hawkgirl find them in their hideout. There are pinwheels all around the room, which is hysterical. Right? And the pinwheels start rolling, making everything invisible. The gang's trying to rush out, but Hawkman bats his wings really fast so that they become sort of partly visible. And this page here, I don't have a page number on mine. It's right across from the Amazing World of DC Comics ad. The world kind of goes pink and sort of almost in that duotone, or I don't know what you call it, but it's very faded. You can tell that it's hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
Pink is kind of an odd choice, but it works on the page, I think. That was really cool.
Unless the anchor just dotted the lines. Maybe. Like, instead of actually drawing, you know, straight, thick lines, they just drew dots.
Or maybe it came right from the pencils. Who knows? You know, that's, I don't know. I thought that was a really cool effect. Almost like a modern serpent-y type thing. IQ ups him once again, and we get the great stuff of, like, all the doll parts that are cut out. And I wonder if you were to take a copy and, like, cut out all the parts, if you could actually manufacture the character.
I'm a little surprised that I didn't do it as a 7-year-old kid. I have a few books where there are things cut out of the middle of them, and I'm surprised I didn't do it with this one.
Yeah, no, this is just great. Hawkman's trying to swing, and his arm is across the room. It's very disorienting, as you would imagine. But then they get the idea to somehow, I wasn't quite sure how they were able to navigate to the pinwheels, but they get the idea, obviously, if they destroy the pinwheels, then it goes away, and that's how they capture the gang. I really enjoyed this story. I thought it was super fun and entertaining and great art.
Again, similar to the Golden Age Wonder Woman story, there's a lot of story in these 13 pages or whatever it is. A lot of things happen, a lot of back and forth. It's not just one or two plot points. It's really interesting, and that's kind of what the hallmark of those Silver Age stories. It doesn't take you 2 minutes to read a 13-page story. Like, it takes you a few minutes to get through it.
Oh, this would keep you busy all afternoon.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You know, this is great. So we did a couple other features. We had a nice ad for Treasuries of Superboy and the Legion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one with the Mike Grell art where all the coming out of the Legion headquarters. And then Superman versus the Flash, which, of course, that's been a couple of years now. They did a facsimile of that one, where I would have read the Flash-Superman races for the first time.
Yep.
I always like this. So this is another thing that's near us. I think I mentioned this once on Batman Family, but there's an ad at the bottom of part one of the Hawkman story for the Warner Brothers Jungle Habitat.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a free safari pass. If you cut this out, you get to go on the safari. That is still there today, and it's part of Six Flags Great Adventure. And it's about 45 minutes from here where we live. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not themed Warner Brothers anymore. It's Six Flags, and it's sort of adjacent to Great Adventure.
Right.
And you can still drive through and have monkeys climb all over your car.
Oh, great.
And drive out with monkey poop. I mentioned the ad for the Science Fiction Spectacular issue of Amazing World of DC Comics. And then there's this, Sean and I talked about this, Todd, on an episode of Batman Family Reunion. From the Heroes World, before it was called Heroes World, you could buy first issues in little bundles.
Ah.
So, you know, we were playing the game, which would you pick? Set A had Tarzan Digest number one, Tour number one, Atlas number one, Batman Family number one, Prez number one. problem with that one is, other than Batman Family, I didn't really want any of those.
Yeah, right.
Set B had Shazam, Justice Inc., Strange Sports number one, Black Magic number one, and Claw number one.
Mm-hmm.
Set E had Shadow number one, The Demon number one, Super Team Family number one, and Stalker number one. Set C had Sandman number one, Shazam number three. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's weird. Plop number one, Joker number one, and Champion Sports number one. D had Shazam number two for some reason. Weird World number one, Beowulf number one, Green Team Special number one. That's a first issue special. And OMAC number one. So which one do you think you would have picked?
I think I would have picked set C. Sandman number one, Shazam number three, Plop Joker number one, and Champion Sports number one.
I think when I was a kid, I would have picked B, which has Shazam, Justice Inc., Strange Sports, Black Magic, and Claw.
Mm-hmm.
But today, I would pick E with the Shadow, the Demon, Super Team Family, and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I might have picked that one
back
then as well. So, but you never know. Anyway, just a fun thing to think about. Whew, I can't believe we're done already. That's about it. So, Todd, I ask everybody, do you think this comic lived up to its special billing?
You know, listen to your other podcasts. I don't know if this is the strongest entry in your collection of books. It's had personal sentimental value to me.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of why I liked it. But rereading it, I definitely enjoyed the Hawkman story and the Hawkgirl story and the Wonder Woman story.
Mm-hmm.
As an older reader that scrutinizes things a little bit more than I did when I was 7 or 8. Superboy story was a bit dull for me. But otherwise,
I think they would have written something that 70 years later a podcast would have.
Yeah, I mean, what were they possibly thinking? You know, not future-proof this book. Again, I think about young Todd down in Cali, Columbia, looking for material to read, and I was just absorbing everything. And so a book like this, 4 different heroes, I didn't probably know much about Hawkman and Hawkgirl. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I would have known Superboy and Wonder Woman. So just to pick up a book that had other heroes that I wouldn't have normally known about, I think was probably the appeal for me at the time. And it's a great concept. It would have been great if they had rotated all the characters in it a little bit more, and rather than just being a Superboy, Wonder Woman story, and then a third or possibly fourth story, to have it completely different heroes, I think would have been cool.
Yeah, I think it suffered from the page count reduction, as we talked about. Marvel was also putting out a lot of reprints at this time, and their reprints were from just 10 or 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Jeanette Kahn came in and said, I don't like reprint books. I want more all new books. And that's the direction they went. And so Nelson Bridwell had to find something else to do after a while, after he wrapped up these books. But I learned a lot from not just these books, but the 100-page Super Spectaculars, other giant sizes. And that's a big part about why I wanted to do this podcast is, you know, not just some of the great all new stories, but a lot of these reprint books too. You know, I didn't know till tonight. I always thought IQ was a bigger deal. And we looked it up before we started recording. IQ had only 5 pre-crisis appearances. He had this one, The Mystery in Space, that preceded it. He appeared once in the Justice League, and then he appeared once in DC Comics Presents and once in The Brave and the Bold. And that's it.
That is surprising because there are other, you know, similar type villains that have high intelligence. I thought he was really compelling, especially it would have been cool to have him come back in a post-crisis Hawkman or Hawkworld book to see what would a modern take on him would be.
I mean, listeners, I'm sure other people, Martin, somebody else will let us know, but I couldn't recall right before we started if there were any post-crisis version of him. The way he gets his powers is a little hokey by soaking up solar radiation, but it's cool when the villain and the hero have to match wits and it's not just a slug out. So I always did like that. So the one-upmanship that you mentioned, I thought was good.
And Hawkman, at least my recollection is Hawkman is not always like a scientific figure things out kind of guy.
They certainly don't portray him that way today.
No, he's like, let me grab my mace and solve some problems.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining me, Todd. I hope you had as much fun as I did.
I did. It was fun to go back and reread some of these books and remember, you know, what it is that appealed to me when I was younger.
And I know we've been talking about doing this for like a year and a half, so I'm glad we finally got around to it. So thanks again. So I'm going to play a short promo or two, and when I return, it is time for the Monthly Planet and listener feedback, so stay tuned.
Return to the House of Frankenstein and enter its horror hall of fame.
4 fright-filled films featuring the legends of terror.
Vincent Price.
I'm going to give the people what they want. Sensation, horror, shock.
Lon Chaney Jr.
I brought that wonderful surprise I promised you.
Peter Cushing.
I know that strange, devilish forces do exist with powers beyond the comprehension of mere mortal man.
Christopher Lee.
Burn, witch, burn, witch, burn, burn, burn.
Plus your favorite superheroes battle macabre menaces.
The Fantastic Four.
The Phantom Stranger.
The Teen Titans.
And Superman.
Tell me where they are, I'll break every bone in your body.
Visit fireandwaterpodcast.com in September and October as the Supermates podcast returns for its terrifying 13th season at the House of Frankenstein.
Welcome back. I am Sean M. Myers, your co-editor-in-chief of the Monthly Planet. In this segment, Paul and I will be discussing the beloved series of DC house ads, The Daily Planet, that ran in the back pages of DC Comics from 1976 to 1981. This month, we are discussing the issues from 50 years ago, covering September 1976.
And as always, we want to acknowledge and thank our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. And you can read all of these Daily Planet. You got to click on Galleries and then Daily Planet, and you can read them all there.
Plus, don't forget to follow our Blue Sky account, The Monthly Planet, for these issues and other fun. Okay, the first one up this month is the week of September 6th, 1976. Batman and Wonder Woman battle Catwoman. It's heroes versus villainess to smash smuggling ring, Gotham City. The ambassador from the nation of Sudaria has been using his diplomatic immunity to smuggle the secret of a U.S. government coding device into enemy hands. But the government brass is not about to allow it without at least trying to stop it. So they call in the world's greatest detective, the Batman. And, unknown to the Gotham Guardian, the United Nations has put its own superhero on the job, Wonder Woman. Two heads have always been better than one, so the two Justice League members join forces and discover the missing link in their smuggling chain, that felonious feline, the Catwoman. Can the Caped Crusader and the Amazing Amazon stop Catwoman before the last part of the coding device is smuggled out, or will they be forced to take seven steps to wipe out? Bob Haney and Jim Aparo serve up the deadly dilemma and its startling solution in The Brave and the Bold, number 131, on sale the week of September 13th.
So what'd you think of this issue?
Yeah, so Zany Haney, yes. He has earned his moniker in this issue.
It's not a bad story. It's an interesting story, but Catwoman adds a bit out of character. At the beginning, one of her big panthers kills one of the ambassadors. She definitely acts and sounds much more violent than the Catwoman that certainly we're used to today, but I would argue even then was a little out of character. Three quarters of the way through the story, she becomes the ambassador and walks into the UN with her panthers and stuff. I'm like, oh my gosh, it reminded me. I mean, I hadn't read the story for a while, and it reminded me of the Joker doing that in the Death in the Family, right? So I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. So anyway, fun story, but it took me out of it a little bit with Catwoman's behavior. That's just me. I don't know what you thought.
Well, the good thing is, since you didn't like her behavior, she dies, so it doesn't matter. Last month, we were talking about outfits. Usually, if it's a horrible outfit, I love it. And I know people do not like this. I guess they call it the swashbuckler Catwoman. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love this Catwoman outfit. I think it's one of my all-time favorite Catwoman outfits. I love it. I think it is fantastic.
Yeah, I don't hate it. The most practical is the one we're used to now, just all black leather, and she just has a little bit of variations to it. And that's been that way since, what, year one, probably, right? But, you know, this one's pretty good. I like the purple skirt one, though, with the slit in the skirt. I think that's pretty fun. But it's not really, it doesn't go with her modern character of being the cat thief, right? When she was first introduced, like, if you read those stories, like in Batman number one and all the rest, with the giant head, right? Those are some great stuff. But she was more of a femme fatale in that she disguised herself. I like this one. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's one of my favorites, but I like it.
It's a great read. Fun reading.
Yeah, fun read.
Okay, our next story. Epstein is Practical Joker, Brooklyn. Practical jokes are the rage at Buchanan High School, and the leader of the Jokers is the Sweat Hog's own Juan Epstein. What kind of classroom capers will Juan pull on Mr. Cotter and the rest of the class? And who will have the last laugh? You can be sure there'll be gags galore when Welcome Back Cotter number 2 hits the stands. Elliot S. Magan, Jack Sparling, and Bob Oxner promise you another unforgettable issue. Oh, the Sweat Hogs.
Do you have this one?
No. The only Welcome Back Cotter I had is the Treasury.
We talked about that last month, or 2 months ago.
Gorillas run rampant. Metropolis, Gotham City, Central City. The Super Gorillas are on the loose again, and DC has rounded them up in another special issue. Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas number 1, on sale the week of September 13th. First, Superman takes on the Super Gorilla from Krypton, a beast whose powers match those of the Man of Steel. Then, Batman and Robin match wits with the Gorilla Boss of Gotham City, as the world's largest gorilla is given the mind of a criminal. And, to wrap up the issue, Gorilla Grodd is back and he's after the Flash, in a story that could only be described by the title, Grodd puts the squeeze on the Flash. Don't dare miss this super battle blockbuster.
Yep, this is a great one. Of course, this one we covered earlier this year with John Staub.
He did a great job. He was fantastic.
That was his first ever recording. Yeah, he did great.
Yeah. Lola Barnett's Comics World. This is the gossip column. Lots of big news this time. Sportscaster Steve Lombard tells me that there's a wild and woolly baseball spectacular coming up in DC Superstars number 10 as the DC superheroes take on the supervillains. And we will talk about that in just a little bit. There are some big changes coming to the Secret Society of Supervillains.
Again.
Maybe she could cut and paste this and put it into like each one of her columns. Batman and Richard Dragon, Kung Fu Fighter, will be crossing paths in the not too distant future. And that would be Brave and the Bold, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember John Jones, the Manhunter from Mars? He'll be popping up soon in a new series of adventures. And in case you didn't notice, that's a hint where he'll be. Now, did that come to pass?
Yeah, in Adventure, he had two issues of back issues, two or three.
Okay. Zatanna and Abracadabra will be starring in DC Superstars of Magic coming soon. That's all for now, Lola.
It's interesting to think back then. Remember John Jones? You know, given that he's more prominent nowadays. When I first started reading the Justice League, he wasn't in it.
I was just going to say the same thing.
And he's considered by many the heart of the Justice League in many runs on the TV show and all that stuff. So it's interesting to think of the time where he was basically absent from comics.
I think the most astonishing thing about John Jones, which may be the most astonishing character trait of any fictional character ever, is that he prefers Hydrox to Oreos.
I thought they were, what's the name of it in the DC?
Was it a fake Chocos?
Yeah, Chocos, that's what it is. So say that again.
No, I'll let my mistake stand. By the way, did you know that Hydroxes were first?
Were they?
And I did Oreos, not know that. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that too, but I think I am right about that. I'll look it up after. Yeah, because everyone thinks, you know, because Oreos are the best and Hydroxes are horrible. Readers, subscribers, editors, let me know if I'm wrong, but I think I'm right about that one. Moving on to Direct Currents. Green Lantern number 92. Denny O'Neil and Mike Grell present a daringly different issue as our Emerald Warriors travel into the past to the days of Robin Hood to learn the legend of Green Arrow.
This was a good issue. I read that recently.
I remember this one, yeah. Superboy number 222. The Time Trapper is back with the most devilish plan of all, which he's cooked up with some help from Jim Shooter, Mike Grell, and Bob Wycheck.
Yeah, we mentioned Superboy and the Legion last month, and also Jim Shooter wrote that. I just read an interview with Jim Shooter like the other day. Jim Shooter, you know, left comics, was gone. You know, he was 13 when he started, so he like went to college, he stopped writing comics for a couple of years, came back briefly to DC, and then quickly moved over to Marvel. So this is in that in-between time when he came back, and he wrote again for the Legion and some other stuff.
Warlord number 4, a must for Mike Grell fans, as his own creation, the Warlord, continues his travels in the world beneath the Earth's surface. Written, penciled, and inked, Natch, by Mike Grell. Trivia quiz number 19.
All right.
Oftentimes, the parents of our characters make an appearance in our magazines. Can you give the names of Bruce Wayne's parents, Lois Lane's parents, Iris Allen's father, Supergirl's parents, both sets? Okay, so Bruce Wayne's parents.
Of course, that's Martha and Thomas.
Yes. Lois Lane.
So Lois Lane, Sam Lane. Mm-hmm. Back then, was he still Sam, I guess?
It is still Sam. And I would have known that, but I didn't know her mom's name.
I'm not sure. I don't think I know the mother. What's the mother's name?
Okay, who is a famous jazz singer? Last name, Fitzgerald.
Ella? Really? Yep. Sam and Ella? I did not know that.
Ella, why did you say that name? Iris Allen's father.
So the real parents are in the 25th or whatever century in the future. Wait, has that story been written yet? Yes, it has to have been. This is 1776. So the real parents, I do not remember. Her foster father came to live with them for a little while. Oh, I can see him in my head, but I don't remember his name.
I don't remember the foster father. I'm not saying you're wrong at all.
No, the father in the current day. Iris was actually born in the future.
Yes, I remember that.
So her real parents are in the future, and I don't remember them at all. Her current day, he was like a professor. He's like an absent-minded professor or something.
Yes.
And he came and lived with them. And I don't remember her adopted mother being in the story at all, but I can't remember his name.
Iris Allen's father is Professor Ira West.
Ira, of course. Ira, I knew that.
And then who ran the Flash Museum?
That was another guy, another absent-minded guy. That was the ex-actor.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I can see him too.
What's up, wrong?
Martin or somebody, just let us know. I'm sure I'll remember as soon as we go off air. And Supergirl's parents. So Zor-El and Allura, a Kryptonian parents. That's easy. And they were the Danvers, Fred.
Yes. Yes.
And in my mind, I keep thinking Fred and Ethel, but that's not it. I don't remember the mother's name either. Man, I've been really poorly on this one.
Edna.
Is it really Edna?
Yeah. I would have gotten Zor-El. I would not have gotten any of the other ones.
Well, Allura, I knew. She was also on the TV show, Allura. Then they lived in Kandor and all that stuff. That was a hard one, Bob.
Bob? Oh, Bob. Yeah, the guy who wrote it. Yeah. I almost said, like, my name is Sean.
My new co-host, Bob. All right, moving on to the week of September 13th. Heroes versus villains in a baseball game. That's right. The Huntress and the Sportsmaster arrange a superstar spectacular. And the location is Crandall Stadium, which is the actual place where it was. Heroes always win, the Huntress tells her husband, the Sportsmaster, but he refused to believe it and proposed a, quote, friendly baseball game between teams of superheroes and supervillains. And so the great superstar game was spawned, and Mr. and Mrs. Menace began to round up players from the two teams. On the hero side, we had Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Robin, Kid Flash, Green Arrow, Black Canary, Plastic Man, and Uncle Sam. And the villains included the Joker, Lex Luthor, Dr. Polaris, Tattooed Man, Felix Faust, the Weather Withered, Kronos, Amazo, and Matter Master. The result is the most amazing baseball game in sports history. And that's, of course, by Bob Ruzakis. Here's Bob again touting his own book, DC Superstars number 10, on sale the week of September 20th. This, of course, was the main feature of DC Special Cast number 1 with Max Romero. It was also in the 300th anniversary episode of the Earth 2 podcast. I got to play the Matter Master in that extravaganza. So we know we love this one. Do you have any other thoughts? Oh, yeah, you've got the digest. I did not have the digest version. I know you like the digest cover better.
Oh, my God. I just think that cover is fantastic. Look it up because it's absolutely beautiful. This is like a work of art. This should be hanging in the Louvre. I love it. And just like the perspective.
I think I put that cover as well in the gallery for our first episode.
Green Arrow way up in the corner. And then Robin even up further than that. Like you have to like really look to see. I love it. I want a collection of this Showcase 100.
These would be good facsimile editions.
Oh my God, yeah.
But they might be a little too esoteric for modern readers. I don't know. You'd think that'd be a good Showcase 100. I cannot believe they haven't done that. That's a great one.
Yeah. I just love stories like this.
All right. The next one we have is The Metal Men Battle Eclipso and Umbra. In South America, the Metal Men had a hard enough time battling Eclipso in their last issue. So how can they possibly fare when Eclipso's master, Umbra, attacks? It'll be a tough time for Iron, Gold, Mercury, Lead, Tin, and Platinum as they take on Eclipso once more and Umbra as he tries to claim the Earth. Marty Pascoe and Walt Simonson bring us Metal Men number 49. So this is Eclipso versus the Metal Men. I had this issue when it came out years ago. I no longer have it. I desperately want a set of Metal Men finest.
Yeah.
I think I have one, or there might have been two showcases of the Metal Men from the 60s, but it's been years since I read any of this. We're long due for some Metal Men love. They would make such a great animated TV show.
Absolutely. Yep. So I know you'll either love or hate that I always talk about DC Finest, but I also need to start hyping up Wednesday Comics, especially like that big hardback collection, because the Metal Men are in that. That has so many good,
it does have a good story.
And the way they're presented and just the art and everything. Oh, I cannot recommend that.
Yeah, that's a great. I had that book. I bought the newspapers when they came out.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah.
When they brought that book out, I bought the book and I sold the newspapers. The book is nicely done. It's really nice.
Yeah.
I think they reprinted it once too, at least once. All right. The Ragman saves a blind child in the city. A blind mute boy unknowingly walks in on a gangland execution and becomes their next target. But the lad has a friend and protector, the Ragman. The race is on. Can the Tatterdemalion rescue the boy before the hitmen get to him? Will the blind mute be able to identify killers when they do appear? The startling answers are in your Joe Kubert, Bob Kaniger, Redondo Studio presentation of See No Evil in Ragman number 3. I read this at one point and I remember enjoying reading the original Ragmans, but I don't have much memory of them. And I don't think any of these are on DC Universe.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But yeah, I'd like to read them.
I'd like to read them too. All right. And then in direct currents for the week of September 20th, we have Hercules Unbound number 8. The strangest surprises of all await Hercules and his friends as they travel the ruins of an Earth destroyed by World War III. They have Michelini and Walt Simonson and Wally Wood on inks. Again, I think I mentioned that was one of the ones a couple months ago that I wanted to read the most. House of Mystery, 248, two stories, The Night Jamie Gave Up the Ghost, David Michelini and Luis Dominguez, and Terror in the Old Mansion, Awaiting the Vampire, Jack Olick and Ruben Yandock. And the second issue of the Super Friends. There's a traitor in the Hall of Justice, and only Wonder Dog can sniff him out as the Super Friends are trapped by the Super Foes by E. Nelson Bridwell, Rick Estrada, Joe Orlando, and Vince Coletta. That is the second part of that two-issue debut of the Super Friends. World's Finest 242. The final battle for the Super Sons takes place in the Town of the Timeless Heroes by Bob Haney, Ernie Chua, and John Callan. The final battle.
Except it's not.
Yeah, because I know they think it's Paul Levitz. Who wrote that last one where they become the computer-generated thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure who wrote it. Remember. But yeah, that's the world's finest in the 80s.
The little trade paperback of all the Super Sons appearances is a hoot.
Yes, I agree.
All right, now we'll go to the trivia quiz. We've concentrated on our superhero line for quite a while. So let's switch over to our mystery magazines this time around. Can you name the hosts or hostesses? Oh, you'll get this one for House of Mystery, House of Secrets, The Witching Hour, and Plop. House of Mystery.
So I know it's Cain and Abel.
Right.
I'm going to guess Mystery is Cain and Secrets is Abel.
Yep.
The Witching Hour are the sisters. I know Eve is one of them.
I thought it was Eve, but go ahead.
Oh, Cynthia.
Cynthia is the attractive one. From the Remember when Rob and I did the Christmas episode? They were in there.
Yeah, I don't know their names, though.
Mildred, Mordred, and Cynthia are the Witching Hour.
And then Plop, is it all of them, but just like in cartoon form?
It's Cain, Abel,
and Eve. And is it his dragon? Is the dragon one of...
It could be. They're just mentioned by Cain and Abel, joined by Eve. I don't think the other witches are in Plop.
Okay.
So I thought Eve was also in... I would have answered Eve for the Witching Hour as well as the other three, but I guess maybe not. Maybe Eve's only in Plop.
Okay, moving on to the week of September 20th, 1976. The Challengers lost in Bermuda Triangle.
Bum, bum, bum.
So you know how in... I swear this is relevant. You know how in Batman Family Reunion we had the most 70s moment?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm bringing that up for a reason. Challengers lost in Bermuda Triangle. Sent there on rescue mission after Kissinger plane vanishes. Bermuda Triangle. When Secretary of State Henry Kissinger's plane suddenly vanishes in the Bermuda Triangle, there's only one team the president can call upon to lead the rescue mission. The four men who've made battling the unknown their life's work, the Challengers of the Unknown. So it's off to Bermuda for the Chals as they begin a dangerous new mission recounted by Steve Skeets, James Sherman, and Jack Abel in Super Team Family number 8 on sale the week of September 27th. And you won't believe your eyes when you see the mysteries they uncover in The Devil's Paradise. Also in this issue, the Doom Patrol learns the terrible secret of Negative Man in a story by Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani, a classic adventure of the world's strangest heroes that you won't want to miss. The only thing they could have added is Bigfoot and a gas shortage. And I don't know how this could have been more 70s. For those who are not of the age, the Bermuda Triangle was a big deal in the 70s.
Sure was. Now, this is great. This is the first Super Team Family had a couple of new stories, was mainly reprints prior to this. And this is when it started, became primarily new stories. They still have the Doom Patrol reprints for a couple issues. This was basically the tryout for the Challengers. Eventually did well enough to get their own title, which was pretty good. This might have been the first time I encountered the Challenger of the Unknown, because I bought this one. I was 11 years old in 1976. Got the Bermuda Triangle, got a dinosaur on the cover that's chasing after them. Like, how can you not buy this comic book?
Okay. So
I am so glad that you have to read this next one.
No. That's not even what I'm sighing about. I'm going to say something. I don't know that it's controversial because I don't know that people care that much. But the way Super Team Family started, team ups, not just a team that you see every single time together. The fact that this Super Team Family had the Challengers of the Unknown and Doom Patrol, no, that doesn't count. Now, if they would have teamed up, then that is great and fantastic. And I know later on, the Challengers team up with Deadman. And I love that because that's a team up. I don't like that they did this. I don't like that it's like a team. And I understand it's not called Super Team Up Family.
It's the charm of Super Team Family being such a wacky title. Yes, someday, listeners, I'm going to do something with Super Team Family. Just haven't figured out yet what.
It needs to be its own.
Yes, I know. I doubt very much it'll be on DC Special Cast, but we'll do something with it. This is great fun, though.
I like the idea of the Challengers. I think it's cool. Yeah. You know, like they cheated death, so why not? Yeah.
Hey, without the Challengers of the Unknown, we would have never had the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, although Fantastic Four had powers.
I get you, but...
Yeah. Okay. My God.
Sean, I'm so excited for this next one.
Signal Man returns to battle Batman. Gotham City. The Signal Man is back. That's right. One of the Batman's old-time super foes is back in action. And this time he's got the Caped Crusader trapped right where he wants him, inside the Bat Signal. Okay, so that kind of makes sense.
You have to admit, that was cool.
Yes. When Commissioner Gordon flips the switch on that super skylight, Batman will be roasted to death. Can the Gotham Goliath escape in time? Don't miss Signal Man Steals the Spotlight, a Len Wein, Ernie Chua, and Vince Coletta extravaganza in Detective Comics number 466, on sale the week of September 27th. Also in this issue, the Calculator is back, and this time his target is the last game of the World Series. Can Green Arrow stop him, or will the cry be, "Take me out of the ball game"? Bob Rozakis, Marshall Rogers, and Terry Austin have really hit a home run with this one.
Martin, Sean got the title right that time. Unlike the entire time we talked about that story, neither one of us got it right the first time around.
Yeah.
Obviously, listen to a few episodes back. You'll hear this episode on Catch You Later Calculator. But I would go so far as to say this might be the Signal Man's best outing.
No. Well, I guess if you're talking outing as far as issue, probably. However, and I've said this before, the best thing Signal Man ever did in his career is escape the hospital by going down the neon lights.
That was pretty good.
That was the greatest Signal Man moment. Now, I have not read every Signal Man comic.
I thought he was like one of your favorites.
I do not have the hardback archive collection. And talk about costumes, man. That's a costume I should love because it's gaudy, but ugh. So thankfully, we are going to talk about the Teen Titans battle the Wreckers in Gotham City. When Claymont Street is marked for demolition and renovation, most of the inhabitants feel it's a step upwards, except for the members of the neighborhood's now 30-years-old street gang, the Wreckers. So the six-pack of aging hoodlums sets out to stop the construction by unleashing a campaign of terror across Gotham and come face-to-face with the Teen Titans. And if that isn't enough for the youthful partners to the world's greatest heroes, Mal gains a new power when he discovers you can't say no to the Angel of Death. Or can you? In this book-length blockbuster by Bob Rozakis, Irv Novik, and Vince Coletta. It's in Teen Titans number 45, on sale the week of September 27th.
So last month, we talked about how Levitz wrote the last issue of Teen Titans. So this must be Bob's first issue because it's by Bob this time. Poor Mal is all I have to say. Anytime I read these stories, I'm like, poor Mal. He gets so disrespected. And then his girlfriend shows up for him and she's way more interesting than him. And still more interesting than
him. And talk about gaudy costumes coming down the line. Although I love it. I do love that outfit.
The horn blower.
I love that outfit. Anyway, so it's funny. Like reading this, I'm like, yeah, I guess I understand why Teen Titans didn't really.
Yeah. Like I said, I love those issues too, but they're not the best.
Moving on to Direct Currents. On sale the week of September 27th, Action Comics number 466. We talked about it last month. Batman is a Bat Boy. Flash is a teenage speedster. And now Luthor's changed Superman into Superboy. You can take the man out of the super, but you can't take the super out of the boy. Is this Kerry Bates, Kurt Swan, Tex Blaisdell thriller? And it's very good.
Read those. Yeah, great part two of that story. Yeah, definitely read those.
GI Combat number 197. The haunted tank gets some unexpected passengers, civilians, and their animals. No wonder they're calling it a battle arc in this story by Bob Kaniger and Sam Glansman. Plus an OSS story by Bart Reagan and Rick Estrada revealing there's no grave for a spy. Tarzan number 256. At last, the startling conclusion to Edgar Rice Burroughs' epic novel, Tarzan the Untamed, as Denny O'Neill and Rudy Flores present The Final Quest. Witching Hour, number 67. A trio of terrifying tales as the witches present Those Whom Satan Hath Joined, art by Frank Redondo. Food for Fear by Jack Phillips and Abe Ocampo. And Dead Duck by George Kasdan and Buddy Granale.
Dead Duck.
Wonder Woman, number 227. Wonder Woman versus Hephaestus. And the life of Julie Gabriel hangs in the balance in this Marty Pasco, Jose Delbo, Vince Coletta chiller, My World in Ashes. Okay, moving on to trivia quiz number 21.
All right.
Not all of our DC superstars live in the present. Can you name five characters or groups whose adventures take place in the future.
All right, so I'm not going to cheat by naming five members of the Legion of Superheroes. Count Legion as one.
Yeah, so they name six things. Four of them are single characters, and then two of them are groups. So you had Legion.
Yeah, one's the Legion, clearly.
Yes.
Other single characters, there's Commandy.
Yes.
There's, what's his name? The Space Ranger?
Yes.
Is Space Cabby on the list?
No, but that probably should be.
Oh, the Knights, the Atomic Knights.
Yes.
The other group. So others, so two groups, Legion, Atomic Knights, other single characters. Reverse Flash? Does villains
no,
count?
But that should have counted.
They say five characters or groups. So yeah, although I don't know, his adventures don't typically take place in the future. He typically comes back to the current time.
It says who live in the future.
Whose adventures take place.
But the answer says, last issue we asked you about DC characters who live in the future. So you've done five. Now, the ones that I'm missing. There's two that they're listed that you didn't mention, although you already got your five. So did you read the DC Finest science fiction one?
I did. Oh, Tommy Tomorrow, of course.
Yes. And now this next one, you could have put $10,000 in front of me and I would have guessed every quote.
Oh, is it that Chris guy?
No, but that's
XL99?
Yeah, no, but that would count. Yeah, is that Chris KL99?
This
DC quote unquote character, it's not like a DC original. It's like a god.
Hercules?
Yeah.
I just talked about Hercules Unbound a little while ago. Yeah, I guess I... All right. All right, our last issue of the Daily Planet this month.
Oh my God, already.
Is the week of September 27th. So this is the fourth one. The JLA battles Adam Strange in the 73rd century. Woo! Green Lantern of that era also takes part. Earth, 73rd century. It is a startled Justice League, which is summoned to the aid of Alana, the wife of Adam Strange. Seems that her husband, the champion of the planet Ran, has been disappearing via a new Zeta beam and returning tattered and torn. But if that were not trouble enough, after his latest disappearance, Adam failed to return at all. So it's off to the 73rd century for Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, and Aquaman as they pursue Adam Strange, Puppet of Time, in Justice League 138. There they meet up with that time period's Green Lantern and are forced into battle against their old friend Adam, the very man they came to rescue. Don't miss this. Cary Bates, Dick Dillon, Frank McLaughlin thriller. This is part one of a two-part story. Next issue, the Justice League goes double-sized, and this story finishes, and Steve Englehart starts writing the Justice League. I'm shocked. The one thing that I'm like, they did not use the fantastic Neil Adams cover to this issue in the Daily Planet.
I literally was
I mean, this is the one. Yeah. You've got a giant Adam Strange blasting his ray gun at smaller Justice League figures in the foreground. Everybody knows it's got kind of like an aqua blue background. It's a fantastic Neil Adams cover. You know, maybe the cover wasn't done yet. Not that this one's bad. This is Dick Dillon and a smaller Adam Strange is firing his ray gun at Superman, but it's a panel from the story from page. I looked it up. Panel from page 8 of the story. Superman's standing with his back to us and Adam's shooting him. Amazing to me that they wouldn't go with the Neil Adams cover unless, of course, it wasn't ready yet.
Yeah, that's my only guess. Yeah.
Fun story. You know, it's a cliffhanger at the end. We don't know why Adam's acting this way. Classic 70s Justice League adventure. I don't know what you thought of it.
I'm kind of divided about Adam Strange.
Really?
Yeah, I love his costume other than the fin. Like, take away the fin. I guess other than Yondu, I don't know who looks good in a fin. I think his costume is fantastic. And again, like you said, that Neil Adams cover is amazing. I guess he's just a guy that gets zapped by a beam and goes to another planet, right? Like, he's just like a guy.
He becomes their hero of that planet. Yeah. And it's a lot of them were like those stories in that sci-fi. I have the Adam Strange omnibus that came out quite a while ago, probably 10 years ago, as one of the earliest omnibuses I ever bought. And I highly enjoyed reading those stories. They're 50s inspired, you know, because he came around like in the late 50s. Carmine Infantino is at his peak. The art's really good. They all hinge on a crazy science fact. When he's in his own universe, and that's the only way to get to Ran, the hook of him disappearing makes sense. But in a world with Superman and all the rest, then they had to invent things like, you know, he couldn't stay on Earth, the radiation builds up, you know, all these things they invented to either keep him on Ran or keep him away from Ran, that sort of defeats the purpose. He suffers from being in a shared universe, unlike most of the other characters, which I like being in the shared universe. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's a dumb character, boring character, or anything like that. Like, I just never really, like, I guess, connected with it. Like,
well, hopefully they'll finest of him, and you'll see some of those stories.
I'll read them, yeah.
Yeah, they're really good. All right, let's move on to another situation where the Flash murders Abracadabra.
It's about time.
This one also takes place in the future, but only in the 64th century. It seems that the Flash is spending quite a bit of his time traveling through time in his own magazine, and he finds himself mysteriously transported to the 64th century, home era of that villainous magician, Abracadabra. As you may have guessed, the malevolent magic maker is responsible for the Flash's timely trip, but his reason is one which will startle you. The title gives away as Abracadabra orders, "Kill me, Flash, faster, faster!" by Kerry Bates, Herb Novick, and Franklin Blackland in The Flash number 246. Also in this issue, Green Lantern appears in a showdown with Jason Woodrow, and now he is half man and half plant in a Denny O'Neill, Dick Illen, Terry Austin stunner, The Fury of the Floronic Man. So this is the origin of how Jason Woodrow got turned into the Floronic Man. I actually read this one recently in some Green Lantern collection I was reading. And The Flash, it's a pretty good story. I think this is also a two-parter. It continues into the following issue, if my memory serves. But good stuff. And what happens is the Flash submits himself to the authorities, you know, because he believes that he killed Abracadabra. And is this the one where they put him in the jail cell and he gets out by throwing the chair in front of him?
Oh, I don't know.
I think this is the one where he can't vibrate out of the cell. And the only thing in the cell with him is a chair for him to sit on. So he starts vibrating at one frequency, throws the chair bounces off. But in the meantime, he vibrates down at a different frequency and is able to go through because the walls were vibrating at the same frequency as the chair to stop
him. Oh.
I always love that gimmick. I think this is that story. It's either this one or the next issue, I think.
Yeah.
Again, if I'm wrong, Martin or somebody, tell me. Good stuff. And there's a great illustration here. It's Irv Novick, vibrating Flash, giving Abracadabra a clobber.
And is that from the cover or is that from the issue?
Probably from the issue too, but I don't recall. Okay. I didn't actually look that up because I didn't read this this week. I've read this year sometime and I was reading all those Bronze Age Flashes.
Okay.
All right, big surprises are coming in our Army at War number 300. Now, this one takes place in the past, in World War II. Editor Joe Kubert has some big surprises in store to celebrate the 300th issue of our Army at War, but he and Sergeant Rock are keeping a military secret. All we can say is that it'll be a battle blockbuster. No fan of Easy Company or the Battle Happy Joes will want to miss, and you better get close to your newsstand fast. So this is a thing that says nothing about what's in it. So I think Bob was really up against the deadline this time because there's no covers on it. He doesn't even have anything to say, but it's like, well, I better tout the number 300. So yeah, we just get a Kubert-drawn face of Sergeant Rock there, no image from the book. And we also get another Lola Barnett's Comics World, Dateline DC. There'll be big changes coming to Wonder Woman in December when her magazine goes monthly. So this is the time where Jeanette Kahn has come in. She's like, I don't like all these reprint books. I don't like all these bi-monthly books. Put them on monthly, get them to be supported or cancel them. So that's why we see all this churn, all these titles like Claw disappear. The Flash and Wonder Woman were both bi-monthly up until this point. Next one, she says, Enemy Ace will be winging his way through the skies of World War I in an upcoming DC special. And that, of course, I covered last year with Captain Entropy. That was a great issue. Superboy will be soloing on DC Superstars in a new story by Kerry Bates, Kurt Swan, and Murphy Anderson. So that one is eligible. I don't believe anyone's claimed that one either. And then watch for double-sized dynamite every month on Justice League of America when he goes to giant size beginning in November, and it'll be all new material. And there are some really big plans in the work for Superman Family, World's Finest, House of Mystery, and GI Combat. And I'll tell you more when they've been finalized. So Sean, what is that our first hint of?
That's the Dollar Comics.
Dollar Comics are coming our way soon. I don't know whether it was Steve Englehart who gave him the idea of the double side, because when he, part of his deal was, he says, yeah, I'll write Justice League for you, because he had written the Avengers, and so he was a big get for DC at the time. But I want it to be double-sized adventures every month, because I want to talk with the characters and all this. And he had the cachet at that time to get it. So I don't know whether, you know, what was the chicken or the egg there in reality. That's what he says. He also says a lot of things. I think he's a little bit full of himself, so I don't know exactly what's true from him. But he wrote a great run of Justice League, as we'll find out in the coming months. Good stuff, Lola. Thank you. And then let's end up with our direct currents on sale the week of October 4th. Black Hawk number 250, another one in a different time period. The Black Hawks faced a final showdown, and one of them will die, victim of Wheel of Death. Steve Skates, Rick Estrada, George Evans. Four-star spectacular number 6. We got The War Between Superboy and Crypto, The Wonder Woman album, Etta Candy, and The Holiday Girls, and Blackhawks. That's the final issue of Four Star Spectacular. Like I said, reprint books are being phased out. Ghost number 51, More True Tales of the Supernatural, as you read about the ghost who would not die, The Haunting Spirits of 76, and The Blackmailed Phantom. So again, this is what they were trying to say. Oh, yeah, these are true stories. We talked about that a bit.
With Martin, yeah.
Karate Kid number 6, The Showdown Between Karate Kid and Commander Blood. Guest starring the Legion of Superheroes in this Barry Jameson, Rick Estrada, and Joe Staton martial arts masterpiece. I don't remember exactly how long Karate Kid, that might have been the last issue of Karate Kid. I don't know if it went a couple more issues or not. All right, for our last trivia question of the month. Last issue, Sean, we asked you about DC characters who live in the future. This time, can you name 5 DC superstars who live in the past?
So I guess I have to be honorable like you and not count every member of Justice Society, which I could do.
Yeah, and none of the ones they mention are Justice Society members, which is weird because they were being published at
That's
the time.
I'll
count you that one for that. We'll give you one for that.
Oh, well, so this is super cheating. Sergeant Rock.
Yes.
The Black Hawks.
That I'll count. That's not on the list, but that's certainly true.
Enemy Ace.
That's also not listed, but true.
That's all that there are in this issue of the planet. Wait, did I say Haunted Tank?
You did not.
Haunted Tank.
I'll accept it.
Who is that? Jeb Sherman? Is that who the...
Jeb Stuart, yeah.
Okay, Stuart, Jeb Stuart. Oh, who's the first... Anthro?
Excellent pull, but not Anthro's, on the list.
He's like the first boy, right?
Yeah, okay. He's not being published at this time, but yes, I'll accept that for sure.
How many? Is that 3 more to go?
The only one on the list that you mentioned was Sergeant Rock. So you've mentioned like 7 or 8.
Oh, okay.
So you've won the contest.
Are they superheroes?
One is. Think of a character who's an earlier version of a current day character.
Oh, so it is like solo members of the Justice Society.
No, Superboy. Superboy I was talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's a bit of a trick. Now think of...
Oh, and he is listed on the...
Now think of another genre that we've spoken about that takes place in the past.
Horror.
What's another genre?
Funny animals.
What's another genre?
Science fiction.
That's the future. I'll try the past. Pew, 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 pew.
War?
Pew,
pew. War? The war books? Oh, Cinnamon, Batlash. Oh, Jonah Hex.
Jonah Hex is actually listed, yes.
Scalp Hunter.
Not yet. I don't think Scalp Hunter
was created. Created.
Well, he might have been. It's 1976. I'm not sure when he was created. He's not on the list.
Okay.
But the other one that was also in that book you read.
What?
It was also in the book you read.
Oh, El Dorado. Tomahawk.
Tomahawk is who they have. So they listed Superboy, Sergeant Rock, Jonah Hex, Tomahawk. But the one you would never have gotten, they list the 3 Musketeers.
I never would have gotten.
I'm like, oh, that's another cheat, Bob.
Wait, what about the gods from Wonder Woman?
Yeah, exactly. The Greek gods, right? You could have had Hercules on that one, too. Woo! All right, now, after all these issues, we'll do our quick run-through. Photo award, Sean, for best art.
Best art. Strange Sports Stories.
Oh.
And that's like the contents page. That's why like there's that big empty yellow space.
You like that
but
one?
But I think that contents page inspired the cover of the digest.
I agree with that. My favorite art, usually I pick one of these Jim Aparo ones, but I really like the Super Team Family art with the Challengers and the dinosaur.
Yeah,
that's a really good one. I really like that. Of course, if they use that Neil Adams cover, there would be no discussion. Best debut or number one?
So I have an idea. Let me look to see if there's any other debuts or number ones. I will go with Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas number one.
That's the only number one. You know, you could consider the Challengers as a debut in their new series. You could also consider the Strange Sports Stories. But yeah, I think we have to give it to Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas. The best comic you read from this month?
Oh, Strange Sports Stories.
Yeah, that would be my pick as well. There was a reason that was the first episode of my show. And then one that you haven't read, or not recently anyway, and want to read now.
Whichever one is cheapest in the back issue bin of either Ragman number 3 or Metal Men number 49.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Metal Men. Whew. Another one in the books, Sean.
Okay, that's it for this segment. Next month, we will, of course, have your reporter feedback. So please leave us some at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
All right, moving on to our next episode announcement. In October, I'll be joined by my pal, Dan Doherty, as we will discuss DC Special number 21, Superheroes War Against the Monsters, Very appropriate for the month of October. And of course, Sean and I will be moving on to October 1976 with The Monthly Planet. Look for it on Sunday, October 4th, right here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now let's move on to your comments from our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. Last month, my guest Mike Atchison and I discussed DC Superstars number 16, The Star Hunters. First up, we had Eric. He said, regarding David Michelinie's name, I've been pronouncing it Michelinie ever since seeing a letters column explaining that it rhymes with pickle my knee. Yeah, I vaguely remember something like that, Eric. Thanks for pointing that out. You're absolutely right. Next up, Rob McCarthy said, I thought I'd read this, but I read Sun Devils instead. Well, hope you enjoyed the episode anyway, Rob. Ido Busnar is next. He said, oh man, I so hear you about wishing this would be collected and resigned to the fact that it probably never will. And the reason I'd love a nice Star Hunters trade is because I've never read any of this, neither the DC Superstars debut nor the ongoing series, and I've wanted to ever since I learned of its existence. Anyway, great show, gentlemen. Enjoyed the conversation, which allowed me to vicariously experience the comic book in question. Well, thanks, Ido, but since then, I've picked up 3 out of the 7 issues at a comic shop for a couple bucks each. I'm looking forward to finding all 7 and sitting it down and reading the whole series in one sitting. I think the only way it gets collected is if it is part of some larger DC Finest science fiction trade from the 70s, which is possible, I guess, but who knows. However, our next commenter, Rich, disagreed vehemently. He said, if it helps any, I read the whole series as a kid, and you are not missing a thing. Even as an 11-year-old child, I knew bad sci-fi when I saw it, but a clueless relative had subscribed me to the series after I bought the special, and she wasn't getting her money back, or at least her money's worth either, since it barely lasted 7 issues and has never been mentioned since, except for a tiny cameo in an utterly unrelated issue of The Brave and the Bold. Rich went on to recommend Dynamo Joe from First Comics instead, which I do remember reading back in the 80s and liking. Sorry I didn't care for Star Hunters, Rich. Hope you enjoyed the episode anyway. Future guest, Ward Hill Terry, came next. He said, another great show. I don't think I bought this off the rack, but I did buy a few subsequent issues as they appeared. I remember enjoying it enough that I tracked down the missing issues by the mid-1980s. Maybe my first complete run. After Man-Bat, of course. I so love the Monthly Planet feature. This was my golden age. Between your perusals of the Planet feature and the Earth 2 podcast's current exploration of early 1977, I'm in nostalgic bliss. Well, I'm glad to hear it, Terry. Look forward to having you on. Next up, Bucky749 said, when I was in Oklahoma with my family, I got my brother and me a stack of comics for $25, and you guessed it, several issues of Richie Rich showed up. I thought you'd like to hear that story. Hey, we always like Richie Rich stories, Bucky. Thanks. Enjoy the comics. Super Captain's next. He says, ah well now, me boyos. I haven't read Star Hunters, but obviously Donovan Flint attended the Sean Cassidy Banshee School of Accented Elocution. Thanks for the spotlight of David Michelinie. One of my most treasured comics is my copy of Superman, the Wedding Album. I have signatures on the book from most of the artists. I still do lack 2 of the writer's signatures, Roger Stern and David Michelinie, though. I'm still loving the Daily Planet features, even if, yeah, the trivia questions are pretty easy. I do have to adjust my comic book brain to Bronze Age for a few of them, such as which JLA members are married. Clark and Lois have been married for so long now, their marriage has almost become a given for me. Fair enough. Thanks, Super Captain. Next month's guest, Dan Doherty, piped in. He said, enjoy the entire show. So informative. Is there anything you guys don't know about DC Silver and Bronze Age? How do you do it, misspent youths? Anyway, your shows have inspired me to continue to chase down the DC specials. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Dan. Look forward to talking to you next month. Next up, our favorite Bat DJ, Matthew Davis, said, I remember the ads for Star Hunters, but never picked it up. Wild coincidence how this was in the works and came out just after the first Star Wars movie was released. Any idea how the sales figures were for this issue? Star Wars sparked an interest in science fiction. I wonder if it helped sales for this. Well, not sure, Matthew. We know the first issue was already ready to go after this special, and it only lasted 7 issues, so it can't have gotten that much of a Star Wars bump. Yeah, an actual Star Wars comics, plus a ton of imitators, you know, so it probably was lost in the shuffle a little bit. Back to Matthew. The way you were talking about Spidey distribution in the 70s, I think I've heard others on the network talk about it as well. It sounds like I was lucky. I don't remember having many missing issues or gaps in my series back then, if any. And I lived in a small town in Georgia. Of course, my main stop was a convenience store right off I-75, and I had other sources, so that could have helped. Yeah, I mean, I'm the same way. I was pretty good luck. Matthew, you know, I would go to the office of my dad who, you know, go to the corner store, and I would read my comics while he was working, you know, so I hear you. That JLA-JSA team-up featured in the Daily Planet was my first, so it's a sentimental favorite of mine. Not sure how many others here collect Funko Pops. They have a series called Comic Covers that features a pop figure in a case against the background of a classic comic book cover. The series included JLA 137 with Captain Marvel. Cool, that's a neat find, Matthew. Thanks a lot. Next up, we have Lizanne Oswald, who pipes in and says, cool podcast, as always. Star Hunters, huh? Not familiar with it. Seemed like a cool enough concept. I do like the leader of that team, though. Can't wait till the next episode. Thanks, Lizanne. Past guest Martin Gray says, top show as ever. I only ever read Star Hunters number 3 through 7. I think 3 was my first. It was the one that opened with Donovan Flint's dark bollock naked in space. Thank goodness for the wisps of space smoke. Or not. It made quite the impression. I'm sure it did, Martin. Looking at the art for the special, it's not Don Newton's best, but he came on quickly over the next few years. The story would have brought me back for the regular series. Well, comics were cheap back then. Donovan's accent was pants, though, but then phonetic accents always are, sugar. The cover logo really is a good one. But when I saw the credits page with a rubbish logo, I guess Ben Oda, his story title treatments in the Bronze Age, generally had a rushed look, and the Grand Comics database says yes. As ever, I love the Monthly Planet. Isn't it typical that you mentioned the weird Western tales featuring Requiem for a Gunfighter, and it turns out to be the title of a just-announced DC Finest Western? You didn't even have to consciously manifest. Yeah, that was weird. That's cool, Martin. And finally, in the which comic came first question, finally, a trivia quiz that required some thinking. Yeah, I agree that was the best one yet, Martin. Talking of questions, why are the secret questions not surprise questions? What's secret about them? Hey, I claim no ownership of secret questions. That's all Sean Ross is doing. Thanks, Martin. Past and future guest and host of the upcoming House of Frankenstein, Chris Franklin says, great discussion, Mike and Paul. I have always been interested in dipping my toe into Star Hunters just because of Don Newton, actually. Newton was one of, if not my favorite artist as a kid, and I was devastated when I read Dick Giordano's Meanwhile column announcing his death. I seem to recall reading somewhere that he had a falling out with someone involved in the Star Hunters series, and that's why he left? I can't remember where I may have read that. It may be conjecture. Maybe the upcoming Tomorrow's book will shine some light on that. Yeah, I remembered something like that too, Chris, but I couldn't recall it exactly or unsure of my memory, so I didn't want to bring it up at the time. Two hazy memories equals one clear one? I don't know. But I am looking forward to that book. Back to Chris. Great spotlight on Michelinie, whose work I've always enjoyed. I was knee-deep in a Spider-Man run that introduced us to Venom and Carnage, etc. Fun times. And then another fun installment of the Monthly Planet. It's interesting that this feature is covering comics from 50 years ago. And over at the 13th Dimension, Dan does a monthly feature on his top Bronze Age covers from half a century ago as well. That Freedom Fighters cover came up, as well as discussion on the overworked Ernie Chan, who was a fantastic artist but was producing way too much work for DC covers back then and seemed spread thin. But I do love the covers for Super Friends number 1, Natch, and JLA 136, because you get a big spotlight on the Earth 2 Batman and Robin. That crossover does have a weak ending, but I'm sure you'll get to that next month. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate all your comments and support. And finally, past guest and host of The Fantastic Four, Brett Young, had this to say. Great show, Paul and Mike. Star Hunters was not something I was familiar with, but the Don Newton art alone is worth the price. Once again, Newton kills it with the different character designs. The main hero looks like what would happen if a sassy Mater D became a spacefaring hero. Everyone has their own unique look. Great stuff. Thanks, Brett. All right, that's it for the comments. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. As always, please leave comments on the show post on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. A reminder that if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This time, special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts, and thanks. That'll do it for feedback section and for the episode. Once again, special thanks to Todd for guesting on this show. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join me and Dan next month as we wage a war against the monsters.